This is Radioactive, a weekly grassroots environmental and social justice news journal for January 30th, 2014. This is Meredith DeFrancesco. Today we look at the impacts of tar sands extraction on the First Nation communities and environment in Alberta, Canada. Climate Action Network 350 Maine has organized the speaking tour Tar Sands Exposed. Athabasca Chippewayan First Nation activist Ariel Deranger and photojournalist Garth Lenz will be speaking in Portland on Friday and Orono on Saturday. Today we speak with Deranger and Penobscot Nation member and Indigenous rights attorney Sherry Mitchell, who will also speak at the Orono event. We also speak with Emily Figdor of Environment Maine and Protect South Portland on the current moratorium there preventing tar sands export if the Montreal-Portland pipeline is reversed. We start with Emily Figdor in South Portland. Last time we had you on the program was when we were waiting for the results of the ballot initiative in November. But since then, there has been a moratorium passed in South Portland. Can you bring us up to date with what is happening with the proposed pipeline reversal movement down there?
Absolutely. Well, that's absolutely right. We lost, unfortunately, at the ballot by just an extremely narrow margin, by 192 votes. And that's after the oil industry spent about $650,000 in the tiny city of South Portland to defeat us. But the fact of the matter was, and continues to be so, that there's so much opposition to exporting tar sands out of South Portland, to shipping tar sands out of Casco Bay, that the City Council of South Portland was forced to act. And so the very next day after the vote, the City Council started to work on a temporary moratorium on shipping tar sands out of Casco Bay. And that work continued. We worked very hard to ensure that moratorium would actually set us up to be able to get the job done to this year in 2014 win protections that are going to keep tar sands out of the Portland and Montreal pipeline and out of Maine.
So how long is this moratorium for, and what does it specifically say?
So the moratorium is a 6-month moratorium. It starts actually from early November, so it goes through early May, and the moratorium prohibits shipping tar sands out of South Portland. So the moratorium effectively does what we are trying to accomplish for a 6-month period, and now our task at hand is to make those protections permanent.
And do you have a plan right now how folks from Protect South Portland and others have in mind to institute more permanent protections in 2014?
Absolutely. So there's a process that's going forward, and Protect South Portland and Environment Maine have been very instrumental in moving forward and ensuring that the process can actually result in the outcome that we're looking for, which is, you know, keeping tar sands out of South Portland and our entire state. And what's set up now is that there is a 3-person committee, a draft ordinance committee, that is going to start working on a new ordinance, and after their process wraps up, then the City Council would actually formally consider their ordinance. The committee was just selected last week, and we're going to work very hard to ensure that they draft a good ordinance and that then there is the political support on the committee to pass it.
In the ballot initiative, it appeared that there were a lot of people in the City Council that actually did say that they had opposition to tar sands coming into Portland, but were not so sure whether that particular wording of the ballot initiative and the repercussions that were potential or conflated would, you know, they were uncomfortable with that. So is the hope then that this will be a more thought-out ordinance that would have everybody on board who did have concerns but didn't feel like they could vote in support of the ballot initiative?
Yes. Absolutely. The oil industry strategy was to attack our ordinance. So they did so, you know, I'd say pretty successfully. They sowed a lot of doubt in our ordinance. And, you know, any policy can always be strengthened when you have a lot of different people looking at it and a lot of scrutiny. So by all means can be tightened up, and we will see this new committee draft a new ordinance that hopefully can bring everyone together that doesn't want to see tar sands come through the South Portland community and through the state as a whole.
And speaking of industry, has there been further reaction to the moratorium, to the work of this committee, and any further public comments about the designs on the actual reversal? Again, we should say they don't have current plans, but all signs before and currently would point to desires to do that.
Well, two updates in that regard. One is, unfortunately, the American Petroleum Institute, which is a lobbying arm for the oil industry, threatened to sue South Portland if it went forward with the moratorium. So, by all means, the oil industry is continuing to fight as hard as they can to protect their ability to move tar sands through the pipeline and through our state. And then second is that we expect really just in the next few weeks, the Canadian government to approve carrying tar sands all the way to Montreal. So they would make the final, they would approve the final changes in the pipeline infrastructure in Canada that would carry tar sands all the way from Alberta to Montreal, meaning that it's then at our doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
So it underscores the urgency of our putting the protections in place to prevent that from happening.
You haven't heard of a lawsuit yet, but the threat has been put out there.
Exactly.
Is there anything else you would like to quickly add as we wrap up, Emily?
I just say that it's, you know, we're continuing to go toe-to-toe with the oil industry, with ExxonMobil in particular, and it's going to take a tremendous effort to actually get the job done and put in place the final protections that we're going to need to keep tar sands out of Maine and to shut down the infrastructure to export tar sands to the rest of the world. So I encourage everyone to get involved and help out, because it's definitely an all-hands-on-deck endeavor.
If people want more information, where can they go?
They can email me at emily@environmentmaine.org. That might be the most direct way to get involved.
Emily Figdor with Environment Maine, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to Radioactive on WERU. Today we look at the impacts of tar sands extraction on First Nation communities and beyond. Climate Action Network 350 Maine hosts the Tar Sands Exposed speaking tour at the University of Southern Maine Friday at 6:30 p.m. and Saturday at the University of Maine in Orono at 2 p.m. We spoke earlier with one of the speakers, Athabascan Chippewayan First Nation activist Ariel Duranger.
My name is Ariel Duranger, and I am the communications coordinator for the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation.
Thanks for joining us today.
No problem.
If you can start talking with us briefly about the impacts of tar sands extraction on the environment and health of people in Alberta, specifically in First Nations communities.
Well, right now what we're seeing is that the Alberta tar sands are basically out of control. You know, development has been going on for over 50 years in the region. And when it first started, it was really small scale. And the impacts were seen, but they weren't really, really negative. And much of the First Nations in the region didn't really fully understand the long-term implications of this until it really began to ramp up in the 90s. Shortly following the ramping up, what we saw was massive degradation to the land. You know, deforestation, removal of wetlands, critical habitat for species, and with massive withdrawals from the river system, which are vital for the communities. These are communities that rely on these river systems not just as recreational resources, but as watering grounds for animals that they survive off of, as roadways in and out of their communities. So my community itself is a fly-in community. So you have to fly in the summer months, or travel by river. In the winter, there is a winter road when the rivers freeze over, and you can drive up there. But it's very isolated. So the river system is a really key center of the community, and it's been massive withdrawals and contamination of this river system. And the contamination of the river system is leading to the contamination of the food sources for our communities, the contamination of the fish, of the caribou, of the bison, of the moose, of the birds, and the ducks. Everything in the region is being impacted by the development in the region. And in, instead of looking at ways to curb the expansion, address the contamination issues, we have a government that is saying full steam ahead, everything's fine. It's not fine. We have recently done a study in our community that had 94 residents participate in it. And of those 94 residents, 22 of them had cancer. 27 cases of cancers in those 22 people. Because these are people that rely on those food sources to subsidize the high cost of food. The impacts in the region are immense. They go all the way from environmental to human and social implications. The Fort McMurray area is struggling as a city even to provide adequate resources from health services to education for the people that are coming to this giant boom town. We talk about this being this great economy and this great safe energy resource, but it's not great because we haven't created the checks and balances to ensure the safety of the people that live there, let alone the safety of the climate and all of the people that run along the pipeline corridors and the refinery communities in the lower 48.
Can you talk specifically about the types of contamination, how that contamination gets into the water supply? Speak a little bit about how the process of tar sands extraction has this immense impact on the environment.
Yeah. So tar sands aren't like any other oil. You know, it's not some sweet crude oil where you pump it out of the ground. It's mixed with, it's a heavy oil. It literally is heavy. And it's mixed with sand and clay and other minerals. And to extract it, they literally have to, in a lot of cases, have to dig it up through open-faced mining. There's other processes called in situ. But what they have to do is they take water and they mix it with the sand. So they dig up the sand in massive swaths. To date, over 1.4 billion tons of earth have been moved to extract tar sands. And they mix this dirt, massive amounts of dirt, in with water and diluents, and they superheat it and they spin it until the tar sands separate from the actual clay and other minerals. And then what's left is this sort of sludgy, toxic runoff that the industry refers to as tailings. And this tailing byproduct that is sort of the leftovers when the oil's been separated is then put into these massive lakes that they call tailings ponds. Now, these tailings ponds are not ponds. These are, I think, the current area of the tailings right now, and pardon my, I don't understand how to convert to miles, but it's about 180 square kilometers of tailings in the region, in the region of my people's traditional territory. And these tailings are not held in ponds that are, like, lined with concrete or any kind of lining. They're literally just earth and dam. So the ground is dug up, earth is put up on the side to create some of the largest dam structures, earth and dam structures of the world, to hold in these giant tailings lakes and end-pit lakes that are leaching into the groundwater systems, into the river systems. There is one tailings pond that it is less than 100 meters from the shore of the Athabasca River system. There has been a group called the Pembina Institute that has done a study that has stated that 11 million liters of toxic contaminant are leaching into the Athabasca River system every single day. This is, in addition to the toxic tailings, there's also the emissions that are coming from the refining process. The fact that these structures run 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and the emissions and the particulate matter is also landing in the snow when we have very long winters, and the snow is then melting and running into the river systems, again, further exacerbating the contamination that's already being felt from the leaching directly from the toxic tailings. This has a huge, huge, huge impact. And then there's the sulfur cake mountains that are, some of them are 8 city blocks long and you know, 3 to 4 stories high.
The what kind of mountains?
They're not covered. They're sulfur cakes, like sulfur, yellow toxic sulfur that contributes to the acidification of the atmosphere and creating acid rain. Sulfur cakes are just sitting there in open fields, and wind picks it up and it's contributing to the acidification of much of the land and an area out there. This is not some sort of easy, sweet, crude practice. And then the oil itself has to be refined multiple times to even become a synthetic crude oil. And in order to ship the oil, once you've separated it from the sand, it has to be diluted. They fill it with diluents, and they call this product that they ship in the pipe dilbit. And this dilbit is highly corrosive because of the diluents in it. And it is it's heavier. So when it comes out, if it sinks and goes into the river systems and the ecosystems, it's not an easy cleanup. And not that oil is an easy cleanup, but it is much harder to clean up than the types of oil we traditionally have used with this new species. This is truly bottom of the barrel energy development that we're seeing in Alberta, and the consequences are dire. And the First Nations people in Alberta have become the canary in the mine to what is the potential of the real human impact that will happen if we allow and approve the expansion and the status quo of energy development in Alberta.
Now, the Athabaskan Chipewyan First Nation is suing Shell, the Shell company, one of the largest tar sands operators, for unmet tar sands impact benefit agreements and challenging the company's application for permits to build new tar sands projects. Can you very briefly speak about that and the lack of regulation or enforcement of regulation on the part of the Canadian government?
Yeah, absolutely. So what has happened is our nation has sued Shell Canada for failure to meet agreements that they made with previous leadership. These agreements happen quite regularly in the region, and this agreement in question was they had promised sort of mitigation, our ability to be a part of monitoring and sitting on reclamation boards, and all of those things haven't happened, so we sued them. In addition, Shell has proposed two new projects, the Jackpine Mine expansion project and the Pierre River Mine, and both of these projects are open-face mine projects, which would contribute to more devastation of the ecosystem, more withdrawals from the river system, and of course, more tailings as well. You know, the Alberta government a few years ago had stated that they would be phasing out of tailings and that we would be moving to new progressive ways and we'd be capping our emissions and we'd be addressing the water quality and quantity issues. But what's happened is instead of dealing with these issues, we just saw the recent approval of the Jackpine Mine by the federal government to allow them to dig up and divert 21 kilometers of the Muskeg River, to continue withdrawals from the Athabasca River system, to continue growing their emissions in the expansion of the Jackpine Mine, to destroy critical habitat for species at risk, including caribou and bison, and migratory birds, to completely annihilate much of our ability to access cultural lands, which are guaranteed to First Nations people in Canada. We have unique rights that are entrenched and enshrined in the Canadian Constitution and the Charter of Rights and Freedom in Canada, that we will be able to access our lands, hunting, fishing, trapping, and cultural grounds, and that nothing should be able to extinguish those rights unless it is granted by our nations. And we have said no. And so Canada is breaching emissions laws. They are breaching environmental standards, species at risk laws, Fishery Act laws, Water Act laws, treaty and Aboriginal rights laws in Canada in the pursuit of economic gain. It is as though Canada has forgot about the foundations and the laws and regulations in this country because they're blinded by the pursuit of money.
We'll be recording you again this weekend and sharing more of the information that you are sharing with us now. Anything else that you want to add, though, today?
No, I just really want to thank, I guess, everyone that has become aware of this and open their eyes to this, because, you know, this struggle is not just an individual struggle. And yes, our nation is at the front lines of this battle in Alberta, but this is something that we all need to understand. This is about the consumption of energy and that we need to be thinking of ways to move forward in a more progressive way that recognizes both human and ecological impacts in the pursuit of economies and energy, not just here in North America, but globally.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Again, Athabaskan Chipewyan First Nation activist Ariel Deranger. Sherry Mitchell will also speak at the 350 Maine Tar Sands Exposed speaking tour at the University of Maine in Orono at 2 o'clock on Saturday. She is a member of the Penobscot Nation and an Indigenous rights attorney with the Land Peace Foundation. Based on the work that you do, Sherry, talk with us about tar sands in the context of Indigenous struggles for community rights and autonomy, particularly in relation to the exploitation of the environment.
Well, I think that there are a lot of people that are working on those issues, such as Ariel, who are very well versed on the direct impacts in the communities. But the larger issues related to extraction practices across the board in Indigenous communities is truly horrific. There are communities all over the globe that are facing devastating consequences in relation to their health and safety, in relation to their cultural way of life, and security for their future generation. These practices are a threat to the immediate health and safety of the individuals that are living within the vicinity of those facilities, but they also pose a great threat to future generations. What do we have to ensure that they're going to have the same right to life that we've been granted? We don't have any assurances at this point. They also interfere not only with title rights to those lands, they also interfere with subsistence rights, because there are subsistence rights that tribal peoples have that grant them the ability to live off in the lands that they inhabit. And if those lands are so contaminated that they're unable to be able to support themselves from the things that are taken naturally from those lands, then that inhibits their ability to be able to live. It's a constructive eviction, essentially.
And Ariel spoke a lot about Indigenous and environmental rights that are being violated in Canada to do specifically with the tar sands, the contamination, but also specific to Indigenous rights that are on the books recognized by the Canadian Constitution.
Right, right. And the thing is that this is not just happening in Canada. I mean, this is happening in Canada. This is happening in the United States. Happening in Central America, this is happening in South America. There's a systematic plan to dispossess Indigenous peoples of their rights. And so you saw a lot of this happen at the over the past 2 years, really, probably more than that. But in the past 2 years, you've really seen a massive uprising to the things that have been happening in Canada under the Idle No More movement.
Yes.
What triggered those things was a series of bills that were passed by Harper's administration, and that impacted tribal rights across the board, impacted the ability of tribal people to access fresh drinking water, deregulated hundreds of waterways across Canada. They unilaterally changed the way that Indigenous people or Aboriginal peoples in Canada, the way that their lands can be taken from them, and reduced the threshold by half. There have been environmental protections across the board that have been taken away, and now there's an educational act that's being put forth that interferes with the rights of the people, the First Nations peoples, to be able to educate their children in the way that they want to. And so this has been a systematic attack across the board on a whole series of rights. The same type of thing is happening here in the United States, where we've seen in recent years three particular Supreme Court decisions that have had similar impact. First, the Carcieri decision, which impacted the rights of tribes in the United States to own land and to place it into a trust status. Then there was another hearing, the Patchak decision, that impacted the ability of tribes to be able to do what they wished with their lands, and allowed people, even in contravention of existing law, to be able to interfere with the rights of tribes to be able to use their lands as they see fit. And then even the Baby Veronica case. So if you take those cases as an example, what it's showing is this sweeping effort to impact the ability of tribes to not only possess their own lands, but to utilize them in a way that they see fit. And with the Baby Veronica decision and with the educational amendment in Canada, an interference with our connection to our future generations. And so it's this systematic attack that's going on Indigenous rights. And a lot of these things, there's big money behind the push for these cases to be heard. And we're also seeing, you know, something similar, this kind of preemptive strikes against Indigenous rights. We're seeing that here in the state of Maine, where the Attorney General's office puts out an opinion that completely changes the rights that the Penobscot Nation has to its waterways. Just unilaterally makes a decision that those rights that have existed since the very beginning have now radically changed. And these types of things are being set up in alignment to the greater foe, which is the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
We just have a couple minutes left, but we would love to have you back on to talk more about the issue you just brought up about the Penobscot waterways. But just in the last couple minutes, we know on Saturday you'll also be speaking about the connection to the North American Free Trade Agreement and the pending Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade agreement with Asian countries. So in the next couple minutes, you could touch on that and the idea of building movements with allies.
Well, I think it's important to just make a note, and I will be talking about those things at the university on Saturday, that the TPP and things like NAFTA, they have the ability to be able to eliminate, not only for Indigenous people, but for all people, the right of local people to organize and to pass their own laws to prevent these types of activities in their own backyard. And so that's something that it's really important for people to become educated about. Some of the work that we're doing through the Land Peace Foundation in collaboration with the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and their Peace Leadership Director, Paul Chappelle, is to go into the Indigenous communities and to educate people on how to build long-term effective campaigns for change and how to address these things strategically, because there is an incredible amount of money that's going into the strategy for dispossessing Indigenous peoples of their rights. And there needs to be an equal amount of effort and strategy and organizing around protecting those very rights that they're attempting to take away. And so that's where my focus has been lately, is really helping people who are organizing around these efforts to really educate themselves on how to become the most effective that they can be.
And that includes workshops with those resisting fracking in New Brunswick and the Fredericton area?
Yeah, we held a training in December in Fredericton. We're going to be holding a training in 2 weeks in Nova Scotia. That's open to all Indigenous people and all allies. It's going to be held at the Tatamagouche Center in Nova Scotia. And then we anticipate that we'll be doing more down the road. We've had requests, actually, to do four more, but we're also raising all of the money for this on our own so that the people on the front lines aren't burdened with that cost, so they can just come, gain access to the training, take the tools that we're giving them, and go right back to work in their communities on the front line of some of these issues.
Anything else you want to say in closing, including where people can find out more about those workshops or the work of the Land Peace Foundation, and then obviously people can hear more about these issues on Saturday in Orono?
Yeah, well, I would encourage people to come out on Saturday if they have the opportunity. It's going to be at the Wells Conference Center at 2 p.m. on Saturday. We're going to be getting into some of these issues in far more depth. The Tatamagouche Center, it's Tatamagouche, I believe. They have a website that has really good information on this training under their programs tab. You can also Google the Land Peace Foundation's website. There's some information there, just a basic outline. It's a brand new website that still has a lot of kinks in it we're trying to work out, but it has some basic information about what our mission and goals are. And we're also working in collaboration with an organization called the Spirit Foundation, S-P-I-R-E-T, and they're actually handling all of the financing for this work. So if anybody wants to make a donation to the work that we're doing, they can go to the Spirit Foundation website, which is just www.spiret.org.
Well, Sherry Mitchell, thanks for joining us briefly today, and we will hope to have you on again in the near future.
Thank you, Meredith.
That's Sherry Mitchell, Penobscot Nation member and Indigenous rights attorney with the Land Peace Foundation. And you've been listening to Radioactive on WERU Community Radio. You can listen to archives of this and other locally produced public affairs programming at WERU.org. And you can listen on demand 12 days after broadcast. Thank you for listening and acting.